Last time we left off on the last Mishnah of the fifth parak, the Mishnah was, we had already spoken about on the previous Amud what happens when a person is davening and they make an error, they get stuck in the middle, they can't go on in the Amida. So the Mishnah spoke about where you would resume when the replacement has, and now the Mishnah says, "Hamispalo v'ta'a simin ralo, v'im shliach tzibur hu simin ralo sholchav." So if a person is davening and they get stuck, they can't go on, which again is not so light. So if a person gets stuck and they can't go on, and again, it's not such a typical common occurrence for us because we have Sidurim, and the same thing is true for the Shliach Tzibur. But it's a bad sign. If a person is davening and they can't go on, so it's, in a certain sense, symbolically suggests that the tefillah is not being accepted. And then the Mishnah says, "Rim shliach tzibur hu simin ra l'sholchav," which I think is true not only in this case, but it's a broader metaphor for life, which is that when the people we choose to represent us don't behave properly, it often is a reflection on the tzibur itself. So in this particular case, if the shliach tzibur gets stuck and he can't go on, and again, he probably did not have a sitter in front of him, so then it's not a good sign for those who sent him. Amru alav al Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. They said about Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa, Shaihayim ispalal ala cholim. He would daven for sick people. Av omer zechai v'zemes. He would say after the tefillah, so this one's going to live, this one's going to die. So just a word about who Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa was. Today, it's probably true today. It's even true today. We tend to think of rabbis as, you go to a rabbi and the rabbi knows everything. Okay, I know not everybody thinks that way, the rabbi, but you're assuming in matters of Judaism and Jewish law, the rabbi knows everything. You mean they have more respect.
Exactly.
Now, the truth is, even amongst great poskim, poskim have specialties. In other words, certain poskim were really specialized in Eben Ezer and areas of Gittin, and some were specialized in Or Chaim. Again, for most of us, you could ask them a question anywhere, and probably the questions you would ask, they would know the answer to the question. But there were people who really were specialists, and you actually find this in the time of the Gemara as well, but in a different way. You had people who were specialists in that they were great balei halacha, they were expert in law, and there were those who were great balei agada. Rabbi Lazar HaModai, who I don't know if he ever appears in the context of giving halachos. I don't want to say he doesn't, but my bekiyos is not that good to say nowhere is Rabbi Lazar HaModai quoted in halacha, but a number of times Rabbi Gamliel is engaged in a debate with his peers about something, a agadic matter, and he says, "Adayim Srichan HaModai," we still need Rabbi Lazar HaModai. And then there were these people who were kind of like miracle men. One of them was Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa, and he will appear, I could be wrong, but I don't know if there's a single statement in Talmudic literature of Chanina ben Dosa quoting halacha. Probably somebody's going to go back and dig out. They'll find one halacha. But Chanina ben Dosa is not known for his halachic statements, but he was known for his extreme piety. Some of you may remember the Gemara in Gittin, in the fifth parak, the famous section of Kamsa Bar Kamsa, all the agados that relate to the destruction of the Second Temple. So there, when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was given three wishes by the genie, by Vespasian. So one of the three things he wanted was a doctor for Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa, because Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa basically was fasting for, if I think I'm not mixing things up, fasting forever over so that the Beis Hamikdash shouldn't be destroyed, right? So he was basically, he survived on a thing of figs, the entire week sucking on these figs. That's what he would do. And the Gemara, I think, has a statement there that the entire world depends on not figs, it was carobs. The Gemara says that the Kol Olam Nizon Bishvil Chanina Bini, and Chanina Bini is supported by, Kav Charuvim, Erev Shabbos, Erev Shabbos. So that's who Chanina ben Dosa was. He was not this, he was an expert in halacha, we certainly don't know that, but he was like a tzaddik. And so he's going to be featured here in a couple of the Gemaras, but in the Mishnah it's described when he would daven, and after he was finished davening, some would come to him, "Please daven for this person, this friend of mine, this relative of mine," and he would daven, he would attempt to daven, and when he was done, he would say, "This person's going to die, or this person's going to live." So the Mishnah continued. What's that?
It's like an approval.
But he wasn't being McCubble. I don't know. This kind of person I know if I would want to go to the crazy because I don't know if I'd want to find out. But Amrullah, they said to him, "Inayin ata yodea? How do you know?" So Amrullahim, "Im shigurat tfilasei b'fi." If my tefillah, when I pray for this sick person, for the cholek, comes out, I'm able to pray with ease, then yodea ani shehu mekubal. Then I know that the tefillah will be accepted. V'imav yodea ani shehu meturaf, which Rashi quotes two interpretations. If he's unable, if the words don't come out smoothly, so then he says, I know that this tefillah is not going to be accepted. Rashi has two readings. One, that the tefillah is meturaf, which seems to make less sense even from A, it's not parallel to the first part of the Mishnah, and B, grammatically speaking, tefillah should be feminine, it should be miturafes. And in second interpretation, Rashi quotes, that would be parallel to the first for the first half, except for, the, I guess, both of them are masculine, I take that back. But the second interpretation Rashi quotes is not that the tefillah is miturafes, but the chola is miturafes. Either way, that's what the Mishnah says of Rabbi Chinan ben Dosa. The Gemara will have a couple of more stories. But in the meantime, the Gemara says, Ahia. It's interesting. I would have said if a person stumbles anywhere in prayer, that's a bad sign for the person. But the Gemara assumes that it's not necessarily the case. It assumes that this stumbling is in a particular place. So, Amar Avichia bar Amar of Safra, Mishum Chad Dibei Rebbe. So the Gemara is going to quote this tradition of Rabbi Chinan the name of Safra, of someone from the Beis Medrash of Rebbe, and there are two different versions as to what he said this about. So, but nonetheless, the first version is Ba'avos. So he said that when the Mishnah says that Kolam Espala V'ta'a, Simon Rahulo, that if you're davening and you make an error, you stumble, you can't go on, it's a bad sign, that's specifically in Avos. If even the first bracha, you can't get out straight, that's really not a good sign. So that's the first interpretation. But then the Gemara quotes a second interpretation, which is...
Would that include Mashin or Rokum or Regeshem?
Well, that's not in Avos. That's in Furos. If that were the case, I think many of us would have a Simon Ra, because how many of us, you know, tonight is the same Talmud of Rafa, so good luck on that. Yeah, exactly that. That's well said. Ikedemastni law, there are those who have this very same tradition, meaning Rechia, Amar Rechia, Rav Safra, Mishim Chadabei Rabi, Be'ovos, not on the Mishnah, which, if you ask me, doesn't make as much sense on the Mishnah, because on the Mishnah, it's like I would assume that any time you get stuck in prayer, you can't complete your tefillah, that's not a good sign. But so instead, the statement that he made was, Ikan namastin la abraisa. What does the braisa say? Hamispalo tzara sheichaven eslivu b'chulam. When you're davening, you're supposed to have kavanah throughout the entire tefillah. But v'im eino yachol lachavein b'chulan, if you can't have kavanah for all of tefillah, yachavein esliba ba'achas. You should at least have kavanah in one bracha. Now, does this mean any bracha? You pick one bracha, whatever your favorite of the day. So the Gemara says, Amar Rechia bar Safra, Amar Rechia bar Safra, Mishum Chad Bei Rebbe, Be'avos. So this actually, to me, makes a little more sense. And as Tosa suggests, that this means the following. If a person is having a hard time focusing, is having a hard time having kavana before tefillah, and they realize it's going to be difficult, so should they daven or not daven? So for all of us, the answer is we daven, because we never have so much kavana generally, even when we have kavana. But for a person who really, when they daven, they have kavana, so there are lots of situations that they're exempt because they're not able to have kavana. The Gemara talks about someone who's bam in haderach, he's been on the journey, he comes home, maybe he doesn't daven for a few days because he's still so worked up over the way that he can't really focus. So here the Gemara says, what does it mean to be able to focus, says Tosa? So if you know, that if you think that you can focus, at least on the first bracha, on Avos, then you should go ahead and daven. If you can't even focus on Avos, then you shouldn't daven. So you may remember, we spoke about this a while ago, that the Shulchan Aruch, the Mechaber paskins, that if you daven, then you didn't have kavan and avos, you got to go back and repeat the Amida. If you didn't have kavan and avos, then Rama says, we don't, you know, for us, it's we don't repeat because no guarantees we're going to have appropriate focus even the second time around. But here, the way Tosus understands the Gemara, that even if a person is not so able to focus on davening, if they can focus on the first bracha, then at least Medina, the Gemara, then they should go ahead and daven. And I think that's, for all of us, it's probably worth I've discovered that it's not so difficult. It is not always easy, but it's not so difficult to focus on one bracha. So one can try to make an attempt at the beginning of one tamida to at least just focus on avos. So you can hope to focus on other things as well, but you know, at some point, for many of us, I can only speak for myself, the other thoughts start to creep into one's head. But avos is usually possible to do with a little bit of taking a stand right before you start davening. Okay. So now the Gemara says, Amru Allah Abba Bechina Pendosa. Minani Mili, how did he know, or how do you know that if when you're davening, again, I don't think this applies to most of us, but where does that sense come from that if the Bechina Pendosa is able to focus, if his tefillah comes out well, that it's a good sign? So, Amar Bishua ben Levi de Amar Kra, Borei Niv Sfasayim, Shalom, Shalom, Larachok, Velakarov, Amar Hashem, Urfasiv. So, Niv Sfasayim means the speech of the lips. I'm not sure how well this works technically, linguistically, but they say that Niv is related to the word Navi, whose power was with his speech. I'm not sure if the roots work so perfectly there, and there's a Nun and a Beis, but Navi is Nun Beis Aleph, the verb, and Niv is probably a hollow verb like Nun Vav Beis or something, but Borei Niv Sfasayim, God is the one who has created the power of speech in our lips. Shalom, shalom, l'rachok v'l'karov mar Hashem fasid. If it is able to come out, if it is well, the speech is good, then it will be peace for the person who you're, I guess, praying for, and God will heal them. So that is the smach, if we may call it that, the pasuk on which this idea leans, that if the tefillah that one is praying comes out well, then the object or the target of the prayer is more likely to benefit from it. Amar Rishi Bar Abba, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. The first wide line. Kol anaviim kulam lolin snabu. All the wonderful prophecies in the eschaton, and what appears to be the end of days that one sees amongst the neviim, mostly the neviim achronim, Yishai, Yirmi, Yecheskel, Treyasar. So most of the all those wonderful things in the future were only given ela lamasi bitol talmud chacham ula osa prakmatja talmud chacham ula mahane talmud chacham min chasav. Okay, I guess this is the rabbi's appeal. So all those wonderful prophecies are spoken with respect to a person who marries his daughter to a talmud chacham, and I think the assumption is that he is supporting them, or someone who engages in business with the talmud chacham so the talmud chacham can earn a living. Or someone who simply allows the Talmud Chacham to benefit from his assets. So all those wonderful things that the prophets describe, so that's for these people. Avol Talmidei Chachamim Atzmam, Talmidei Chacham themselves, Ayin Lo Ra'osa Elohim Zulasecha Yasei Lemchak Elo. The prophets were not shown what the reward is for those people. Okay. So this is one version of how to understand what the idea is, what God has not shown to any of the prophets. There's a different tradition that Rav Chiya Bar Abba quotes in Rabbi Yochanan's name. The Amar Rav Chiya Bar Abba, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Kol ha-neviim kulam l'nisnabu ela limos ha-mashiach. All those prophecies that you see are only for the Messianic era. Avol la'olam haba. So olam haba is the world to come. That's something different. I'm not going to delve greatly into these eschatological matters. The Rambam has a comment, I think it's at the end of Hilchos Malachim, where he says this is what he thinks the order of things is supposed to be in the end of days, but it's not entirely clear, and so we'll find out when it happens, basically. So I will read the Gemara, but I can't really comment so much. What is the connection here? I'm trying to remember. I was thinking about this when I was going through this. What is the connection? There are a couple of other statements here, but I'm trying. Why do they pick on this particular pasuk? I think I know where it is. It's in Yishai. They're both Yishai, but it's not the same place. I don't know why. It's a good question.
It goes back to Harnina Bendosa about, you know, why did he feel.
No, that's why Borei Nisfasayim is here. But why is the statement of Chiya Bar Abba Rabbi Yochanan, which is going to be a series of statements for. Oh, I know, well, yes, I'll tell you why. Because the last statement has that pasuk of Shalom, Shalom, Larachok, Lakarov, which was used here. So the first two statements, the Chiya Bar Abba Rabbi Yochanan, are are unrelated, but they're tied to the third statement. They come as a chain. And the third one is going to talk about the same verse that was needed for B'chanina ben Dosa. Okay. Thank you for asking the question. So the second one is Kol Anavim Kulal Nisnabu Lalimos Hamashiach Aval Olam Haba Ayin Lo Ra'asa Elohim Zu Lasecha. So all the prophecies of the prophets are only for the wonderful things in the Messianic era, and some of these prophecies are somewhat supernatural. But Olam Haba, the Nevi'im did not get any glimpse of. That they couldn't even describe to us, because that's very, very clearly beyond. Upliga de Shmuel, and this last statement, the Rabbi Yochanan, disagrees with Shmuel's statement. The Amar Shmuel, Ein Bein HaOlam Hazeh Limos HaMashiach, El HaShibud Malchias Bovad. This is, I think, a famous statement, a vision that probably maybe speaks more to us, that the only difference between now and the Messianic era is the persecution of the nations, but everything else in the world will remain the same. Shenemar ki lo yechdal avyon mikerev haaretz. In other words, Messianic era is not some utopia. There's still a challenge, you might call social issues, there's poverty, but what you have in the Messianic era is Jewish sovereignty and a lack of persecution of the nations. Then, the Amar Chi Bar Abba. What's that? No, because many of the prop no the garza avim keves and amerim gedir butz. Firstly, even as part of the Messianic era for Shmuel Sheba Balchios, you don't necessarily have world peace. You just don't. We're at peace, and certainly the descriptions of the lion lie down with the sheep and the etc. And the lion will eat straw. So lots of the prophecies in the Nevi'im go well beyond just we have Jewish sovereignty and Jewish independence and we're not being persecuted by the nations. Shmuel's vision of the Messianic era is a very narrow one.
So Shmuel is saying that those Sukkim are actually talking about
Olam Haba. Yeah, a world to come.
So where do we know about Imos Mashiach then?
Where do we know? Well, I mean, it would simply be God's promise of redemption, the Shava Shemesh Voschavari Hanecha. Okay. So then, now we get to the question that David was asking, what is this doing here? It's the third statement of Rav Chiya Bar Abba in the name of Yochanan, which is on the fifth wide line near the end. The Amar Rav Chiya Bar Abba, Amar Rav Yochanan, Kol HaNeviim Kulan Lo Nisnabu, Ela Lebali Tshuva, Aval Tzadikim Gemurim, Ayin Lo Ra'asa Elohim Zu Lasecha. So this statement is also going to be disputed, and this is somewhat of a famous dispute. Rav Chiya Bar Abba's statement in the name of Yochanan is that all the wonderful things in the Messianic era is the reward of those people who are Balei Tshuva. Now, first thing I should comment here is I'm not sure what Balei Tshuva means in this particular context. So one of the Gedolim, I don't know, once said, he said, we're all Balei Tshuva because every one of the things we have to fix. The term Balei Tshuva today has a certain cultural context. It means typically someone who didn't grow up in the Orthodox community, who didn't grow up observant, typically we would say of Shmir Shabbos and Kashrus. I don't know what it means in the Talmudic context exactly, because today there's such a thing, post-Enlightenment era, there's such a thing as being Jewish but being secular. Before the Enlightenment, there was essentially no such thing. If you weren't Jewish, let's say in medieval and Ashkenazic Europe, you were Christian. Within the Jewish community, so there was only one form of Judaism. It was called, I'll call it, even though sometimes, at a certain point it's anachronistic, Shulchan Aruch Judaism, it's halacha. There are the norms in every community. Not everybody did what they were supposed to do in various kinds of areas. So when you go back to the rabbinic era also, I don't know what it means when we talk about Balei Tshuva. If you read the Gemara literally, a Balei Tshuva means someone who never sinned. There's no one who never sinned, but so I don't know. Today we have sociologically, we have sort of categories, but I don't know what it means in this particular context, other than the fact that people who've done, had to do tshuva because they didn't always do things properly. So Chiya Bar Abba said, in Rabbi Yochanan's name, that the prophecies of the prophets describe the reward of Balei Tshuva, but what is unseen, was unseen by the prophets, because it's clearly so far beyond that, was what Tzadikim Gemurim receive. And now the Gemara says, Upliga the Rabbi Abba. The implication here is that someone who's a Tzadik Gomor is greater than someone who's a Balei Tshuva. But the Gemara then says that this disagrees with Rabbi Abba's statement, because the Amar Rabbi Abahu, Makom Shebalei Tshuva Omdim, Tzadikim Gemurim Enam Omdim. The place in heaven where Balei Tshuva stand is a place that even Tzaddikim and Gemurim can't. And the assumption is that Tzaddikim and Gemurim, who've never sinned, so they don't really know what it is that they're missing. Whereas Balei Tshuva, who've made a sacrifice, they know exactly what they're missing. So when they observe, their observance is that much more challenging, and therefore their reward is that much greater. And now he quotes the Pasuk, which is, Shenemar, Shalom, Shalom, L'Rachok V'L'Karov. L'Rachok B'Reisha, V'Hadar L'Karov. When God offers his greetings of peace, first it's to L'Rachok, those who were far away, and then it's to L'Karov, those who were always close. And what is Rabbi Yochanan going to deal with this? Because Rabbi Abraham, Rabbi Yochanan said, you know, that nope, that Balei Tshuva don't reach the place where Tzaddikim Gemurim were. So he says, Rabbi Yochanan Amar Lecha, he would say to you, my rachok, shahaya rachok midvar avera meikara, umay karov, shahaya karov lidvar avera meikara, v'nisrachet mimenu. Which would prove that in certain contexts, this almost the gates of interpretation are never closed. He says, Rabbi Yochanan would say that rachok would mean not someone who was far away from God, even though that's the simple reading of the pasuk, that you give greetings, la rachok, and then la karov, but rather someone who was far away from sin, and then someone who was closer to sin, but now no longer is close to sin.
Rabbi,
yes?
I never was clear about the statement about the tshuva and the tzaddikim gemurim, because if you're a tzaddik gemur, it means you never were tempted, you're surrounded by temptation, you're surrounded by the world, and you were never tempted. As compared to a Balei Tshuva who didn't know any different and changed it, and changed his approach. A Tzaddik Gomer is a much higher level, because he never was tempted, or she never was tempted.
As I heard your sentence, I wasn't sure which way you were going to go with this. Yeah. Right?
Well, you know. Basically, a Tzaddik Gomer should be in a higher level, because he never was tempted. He's a perfect Tzaddik. He's perfectly...
I would say, if you told me a Tzaddik Gomer is someone who was tempted but never gave in to the temptation, then I would understand. That's different than someone who was never tempted.
No, okay. He or she are human beings, surrounded by temptation. So he's a tzaddik gomer because he never gave in to temptation.
Well, that's a different issue, but one might say, the flip side to that, if you never tasted it, you don't know exactly what you're missing, so it's not quite not quite the same thing. I think the flip side, which is an idea which is, I think, in other words, Rabbi Abbo's statement is readily understandable, which is that the person who... in light of, let's say, Yechezkel's prophecy that, you know, the Russia who does tzaddik, you know, who does tshuva one day before his death, God wipes away his entire slate and he's accepted, and the tzaddik who, you know, the last day decides to go astray, then that will, his tzidkus, his former righteousness, will not save him. So what I would say is that idea certainly, I think, plays into the Rabbi Abbo's idea is that it's that a person who has known temptation, and I would add something, it's not just temptation, it's habit. Right? Part of the way we are as human beings is that we are creatures of habit. And a person who has never sinned, even if they're tempted, they are fighting only one challenge, which is, it looks appealing. But once a person has been habituated, then it's very, very hard to change. And that's the great challenge of any one of us who... We all know that, you know, whether one is in the sociological category of Balei Tshuva or like everybody in our community who are Balei Tshuva, we hope are Balei Tshuva in some sense, who do try to change our behavior. We all know how difficult it is to change behavior. The flip side to it is, I think, a concept which we don't think about enough. It's a challenging concept. The idea, why is it Tzaddikim Gemurim would be on a greater level? So, meaning the person who never sinned, which again, realistically, is none of us, is because there is a notion that's very foreign to our modern conceptions, that sin leaves a stain. Right? When you read Chumash as an example, so the idea that you bring a certain karbanos are brought, lechaper, I would say, or certain sins are litameis mikdashi. I understand that a sin is wrong, but there's a language of defilement. There's language that murder defiles Eretz Yisrael. It defiles the karka in a way that we would think, you, the person did a sin, and the person gets punished, and we've done our responsibility. Yes, but there's a stain that the sin leaves, and one of the functions of kapara, of karbanos in certain contexts, is literally kapara means to wipe away. It's to clean up the sin. The Nevi'im taught, Yirmiyahu talks about, Kiyim techabsi baneser v'sarbi lach boris nichtam avoneich lefanai. Even if you have all the soap in the world, your sin is still stained before me. I mean, that's when they haven't really done tshuva. But the idea, metaphor captures a certain philosophical or theological approach to sin, that whenever we do something wrong, it leaves an impression. The purpose of kapara is try to clean that up. But it's not always easy. As we know, sometimes there are stains that are, even if they fade, they're somewhat permanent. So the idea that a tzaddik gomer, which again is none of us, is different than someone who is a baal tshuva, which is all of us, is that the avera still leaves, even as we clean it up, it still leaves a kind of a sin. You know, and we tend to think, and it's true most of the time, that tshuva cleans up everything. Almost. But for example, a Kohen who has worshipped Avodah Zarah, or a Kohen who killed someone, let's take the contemporary, I hope it doesn't come too commonly, a Kohen who's killed someone cannot duchen. Right? He cannot go up to Duchen with his fellow Kohanim, because Yudeichem Damim Aleihu is the pasuk in Yeshaya that they learn it from. Now, we don't really learn psukim, we don't learn halachas from Nevi'im, but the idea is that this Kohen, whose hands have shed blood, even accidentally... I don't know how we paskin in those two issues. Well, let's say a person kills in self-defense. I don't know how that works. But let's say a shogeg, not that's permissible, just as an accident, but enough that are liable... What's that? Menashal Habar. Yes. So that leaves a certain kind of stain. It's something that, again, it's our thinking, and it is the way we live and mostly should live, is you apologize for something, and the person is supposed to forgive you. But the truth is, in our interpersonal reactions, depending upon the personalities, even when you apologize, even when you make good, often there's still a memory, there's still a pagam that the person will feel, even though they're your friend, even though they made up, they're your spouse, whatever it is, it leaves something there. So with sin and our relationship with God, it's not fundamentally any different. So that, I think, that's the angle when you say that b'makom shetzadikim omdim bali tshuva enam omdim, that a person who has never had any stain of sin is in a different place, and someone, no one else can approach that place.
The two perspectives, right?
Right.
Right. And each has...
Yep. Each one is correct in its own right. Yes. Okay. So the Gemara now says that going back to the pasuk that Rabbi Chiya bar Abba had been quoting Rabbi Yochanan's name, what is Ayin lo ra'asal elokim zu lasecha yasei lemachake lo? So now the Gemara says... Hashta, in other words, if you're going to say, I think Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, Amar Rabbi Yochanan said that which the Nevi'im prophesied, that's what Balei Tshuva received. But the things that the Tzadikim Gemur will receive, no eye has ever seen it. But if you believe, as Rabbi Abo does, to the contrary, that nobody can approach the level of a baal tshuva, so then what do you do with what is ayin lo ra'asa elokim zulasecha yaseh lechake lo refer to? So Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, zayin hamashumar ba'anavav b'sheshes yimei breishis. Okay, this doesn't really speak to me at all. And Marshall knows I'm not much of a wine drinker. Larry probably knows that also. So the wine that has been kept in its grapes since the 6 days of creation, that's, if you really like wine, so you're in for a treat, apparently. That's one...
A metaphor for, like, learning or something like that in the grapes.
What's that?
It's a metaphor for, like, Torah.
I appreciate that on my behalf you're darshaning. But I think in its context, whatever it means in its context, what it's supposed to invoke is, to appreciate this agada, you have to appreciate really good wine. Okay, and then the Gemara continues. Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani Amar, no, ze Eden shelo sholto ba'ayin kol beria. This is actually a reference to Eden that no human eye ever saw. Now you're going to say Shema Tomar Adam Arishon Hechon Haya. Where was Adam Arishon? Wasn't he in Eden? The answer is no. He was Bagan. He was in the garden. V'Shema Tomar Hugan Hu Eden. That's the same place. Talmud Lomar. And it's very good reading of the pasuk. V'nahar yotzei me'eden lahashkos esagan. There was a river that came out of Eden that would then water the garden, and it would then split into four heads, four tributaries, as the pasuk continues, and therefore you see that it is Gan Luchud, the Eden Luchud. So Adam and Chava were in Gan Eden, but they weren't in Eden. Okay. All right, I don't have much more to say about this. So now, the Gemara continues. Hanu Rabbanan, I would say story time. Masa Shechala Benosha Rabbi Gamliel. Rabbi Gamliel's son became very ill. Shagar Shnei Talmidei Chachamim Eitzel Rabbi Chanina Ben Dosa Levakesh Shel Avrachamim. Rabbi Chanina Ben Dosa sent, Rabbi Gamliel sent two Talmidei Chachamim, two Rabbi Chanina Ben Dosa, to ask him to daven for Rabbi Gamliel's son. Kevan Shira'a Osam, Ola La'aliyah, Uvikesh Shel Avrachamim. When he saw them, he went up to the aliyah, and he davened for them. Now, this is a very interesting agada. I wish I had pulled it out. There's a agada that sounds a lot like this, but it's actually a very different thrust in Tainus, where a certain very righteous person and his wife, so they were sending to them to pray for rain. And before the messengers arrived, they knew they were coming. They went and prayed for rain so that nobody would know it was their prayers. So here, when I read this Gemara, I'm about to think, well, Chanina Mendoza goes up to the Aliyah to pray, so they won't know he's praying, and he'll come down and say, well, you know, go see how he's doing. But that's not what happens in the story, actually. So I think that the reason he goes up to the Aliyah is because he wants seclusion. The other person who prayed in Aliyah was Daniel, in the book of Daniel, but he prayed in the Aliyah because there was a decree against prayer. He didn't want to get caught. Anyway, he goes up to the Aliyah, and then he prays for him. Beyiridaso Amar Lahem, when he came down, he said to them, Luchu, go back, Shechaltzatu Chama, that the fever has broken. Omru lo, v'chi navi ata. They asked him, are you a prophet? Amar Lahem lo navi anochi, lo ben navi anochi, which is Amos's famous line. Elakach mekublani. I'm not a prophet, the son of a prophet, but I have the following tradition. In Shkura Tfilasa Bafi, if my tefillah, if my prayer comes out easily, Yodeani Shehu Mekubal. I know it's received, and Lav Yodeani Shehu Meturaf. Otherwise, I know that it is torn up. Yashvu Vakasu Vakivnu Osasha. Now, in the modern day idiom, we would say they looked at their watches. The reality was, of course, they couldn't look at their watches because they didn't have watches. When it talks about to be mechavein es hasha'a, to determine the time, it's because you couldn't easily determine time. So it's supposed to be doing this, and then they went on their way. They checked out the shadows. They wanted to see exactly what time it is. The Chanina ben Dosa said that the fever broke. And then what happened was, Shabo Eitza Rabbi Gamliel, Amar Lahem, he said to the messengers who told them the time, Ha'avoda, which is a language of Shvuah. By the worship in the temple, I swear. I mean, he wasn't swearing. Lo hasartem velo hasartem. It wasn't early or wasn't late. You got it exactly. Elakach hayamaisa ba'osa shah. This is what happened. Ba'osa shah chaltzatu chama. That's when the fever broke. V'sha'al lanu mayim lishtos. And he asked for water to drink. V'shub maisa b'Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa.
He said he went up to the Aliyah. Is that
his attic, the second floor. You have this there. As I said previously, all the important things happened in the Aliyah. Firstly, Bibnei Brak in the Seder, that's where they're Mesubim Ba'aliyah Bibnei Brak. The whole the discussion of the Gimel Averos, the three sins which you have to give up your life for, that was Ba'aliyah Benitza, Ba'aliyah Snitza, Ba'aliyah Space Nitza Belod. All these things happening. I don't know why everything important when they would do the Sota Ibor, when the Beis Din would sit down to do the calculations to determine whether to make the year leap year. So it was done in a small number of people, and they would go up to the Aliyah. I don't know. You know.
Is there any other reference in Tanakh to Aliyah other than the reference you made to Daniel?
The Nasana Aliyas Kir Kitana by the Shunamis makes for Elisha. She made him a little room in the attic.
Well, because the davening is supposed to be Shemalos Mimamakim. So they're going up and.
No, that means within a room you shouldn't be standing on a platform. But the floor, your starting point is the floor. So I don't know why. The Aliyah, so I assume it's partially a place of seclusion. You didn't have generally, does not seem to have permanent steps. You seem to have a ladder. There's a Gemara that talks about, it's not a Gemara, like one of these weird mesechtas where the guy has a guest and he doesn't try, he doesn't know the guy, he's a stranger. So he puts him in the Aliyah, but he pulls the ladder away in case the guy's a thief and trying to steal stuff. And if that's Kabdeu v'chashtehu, Shlom Honor and Suspect. And that's that story. And the guy breaks his neck because he was trying to come down at night to rob it. So you were talking about like permanent steps. So I imagine the Aliyah is something. The Aliyah is something that that is not a typical place that people reside. It's a place where you have quiet, seclusion, secret, and so on. So anyway,
I was just saying they may have had animals on the first floor with them, and so therefore it's a place where you can really focus without, you know, animals and their mess.
That could be. Some of us would say we had little children on the first floor, but no. Okay, that could be. So, the second story is Bishuv Maaser Rabbi Chanina Mendoza. Shehalach lomo Torah itza Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. He went to study Torah with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. The chala bino shor Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's son got sick. So Amar lo Chanina bini. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, Chanina, my son, my student, bakesh shel Avraham in v'yichya, daven for him. He niach rosho ben birkav ubikesh shel Avraham in v'chaya. He put his head between his knees. He prayed, and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's son lived. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai observed, Ilmale hitiach ben Zakkai es rosho ben birkav kol hayom kulo. I could have done the same thing all day davening. Lo hayu mashkichim olav. He's speaking about himself in the third person. He's pulling a Bob Dole, for those who remember. Yeah. So he says, if Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had stuck his head between his knees all day, they wouldn't have listened to him. So Amra lo Ishtar, his wife said to him, "Chi Chanina gadol mimcha, Chanina greater than you." So Amra lein lav, no. Elahu dome ke evan lefnei hamelach, vani dome ke sar lefnei hamelach. He's like an evan lefnei hamelach. He's one of the like in the chambermaids. In other words, he has an intimate relationship with the king. That I might be greater, I might be have the status of a noble, but I can only see the king on occasions. But he has that intimate connection with the Ribono Shel Olam, and that's why his prayer is more makubal. Right, in fact, you know, we used to know this. In, you know, the most important thing, you know, in YU was not knowing the you know, the high level administrators. You needed to know their secretaries and assistants. That was how you got anything, because that's how you would get in. Because if you need to find out something from the president, well, you're not going to get to talk to the president, but the secretaries talk to the president all the time. So that was, you know, David's nodding his head. His more recent, you know, amongst, I know there are old people in YU also longer ago, but we, and I assume that's true in every single institution. That's the way it is. It's knowing, no, it's the person who is Eved Lefnei HaMelech as opposed to the person who is Kisar Lefnei HaMelech.
It's also interesting that his wife brought this up.
Well, she was like, well.
Worried about his ego.
What's that?
Worried about his ego.
Well, yes, and she was kind of, listen, she figured, David, that she married him. Whatever she had to put up with being his wife, it's like there's some perks that are supposed to come with it. So how come my son gets sick and you got to go to him to pray? You're the big rabbi. So.
The Rosh Obein Bruchov, I mean, that wasn't, you know, we have an early demarriage a few weeks ago.
Well, that's because we're totally not flexible. That's because we spent our lives sitting in chairs and we're not flexible. It's an expression, but it means to put one's head down. It means to focus and concentrate and shut everything out. Yeah, that's what I think it means. Okay. Yes.
It's a little bit like in the last days of Rav Soloveitchik's life after his wife passed away. So one of the Bohrim would become the shamash of the Rav.
Yes.
Rabbi Adler was one of those people.
Rabbi Brander, I believe, was the last
Rabbi
one.
Rabbi Brander, yeah. Those people had a special relationship with him.
Right. Lahavdil from this, because I have to say Lahavdil in this context, you get to know a person more intimately when you see them in their more unguarded moments. It's a more personal relationship. Yes. So, Lahavdil, this is what this is like. Obviously, I don't think there's such a thing as God in an unguarded moment. That doesn't mean anything, but nonetheless. Okay, last statement. He's not done. But this is not Agad anymore. Al yispalal adam ela b'bayi sheyesh sham chalonos. And we saw this at the beginning of the parak, actually. It's a little bit of closure here. On the first Amud Aleph in the parak, that you're supposed to daven in a room that has windows. There's a tradition in the Zohar that's, I think, quoted by the Shulchan Aruch, which is it should have 12 windows. I have not studied any of the history of this, but I would not be surprised if the practice of having, I know I've been in many shuls, I grew up in a shul like this, my current shul has windows for each of the shvatim, So I wonder if this is, in fact, even though they're not always technically separate windows, if this is a reflection of this practice mentioned by the Zohar. But either way, the Gemara just says you're supposed to have windows, and they quote the pasuk from Daniel, which the Gemara at the beginning of our parak quoted, V'chavin psichon le be'ilisei neged Yerushalayim. The word kavin is the Aramaic word for chalon. So windows were open in his aliyah facing towards Jerusalem. The question of why are you supposed to have windows? What is the point of having windows? So Rashi says, "Shegormin lo." The second to last Rashi, "Sheichabin libo, shumistakel klape shamayim b'libo nichna." By looking out and seeing the majesty of nature, seeing the heavens, it will induce humility. Rabbeinu Yonah quotes this. He quotes another suggestion that when you kind of see looking out, he says the light somehow helps a person focus more. Okay, I don't know. So I can't speak from my experience to that, but that's what he said. Then, speaking about the place of prayer, Amar Rav Kahana, Chotzif alai man demitzale bebikta. He regards it as something highly inappropriate, someone who davens in a bikka. Bikka is a wide open space, like a field. Rashi says that the reason why you're not supposed to daven in a bikka is because when you daven in a secluded place, he says, Chala alav emas melech v'libo nishbar. The sense of God falls upon you in a way that's different, and it creates a breaking of the heart, not in the sense of emotional breaking of the heart, but a kind of humility. An experiential thing. Is that really true? Is prayer different when you daven in a wide open space as opposed to daven in a narrow space? I don't know. Others, I think Tosis suggests that the reason it's problematic is because, not because of intent, not because of focus or kavana, but because if you daven in a wide open space like a bikkah, you're likely to have your tefillah interrupted by somebody passing through. So you're not supposed to ideally daven in a place where you're going to be interrupted or disturbed. So that's Tosis's question.
Oh, okay.
So he says that it wasn't really a sadeh, it was Har HaMoriah, but it's called the sadeh. The Gemara talks about how it's not, I forget what Avram it says, not like Avram, not like Yitzchak, but I forget, but it's supposed to be, it's called Har. But Yitzchak is the one who called it a field. So yes, it says that, but it wasn't really a field. It wasn't like an open field in the middle of nowhere. It was on top of a mountain. Okay. And then the last statement, V'amar Rav Kahana, Chatzif alai man de mefarish chata'ei, shenemar ashrenes surifesha kisuri chata'a. I'm not sure what kind of a statement this is. I guess, if I had to guess, it's like Rav Kahana spent one too many times in shul listening to the guy next to him spelling out all the things he did, you know, against God, and it's like, I don't want to hear that. But there is a question whether one is supposed to, when one does vidui, whether one is supposed to, in a manner that might be publicly heard, whether one is supposed to specify one's sins or not. And the distinction we actually draw is that sins that are known are sins that a person should confess for. But if someone has sinned in a manner that nobody else knows, then it's inappropriate for one to publicize that, because that's a chil Hashem, because people don't know that you've done it, so better that people not know the things that were done. But once it's known, you're supposed to publicly confess those things so that there's a recognition that you acknowledge, people realize that you acknowledge what you did wrong, because they knew what you did wrong, and it's important for them to hear the acknowledgments. Hadran Allah Ein Omdim. Okay, so moving on. The sixth parak of Brachos, as I mentioned before, Chaviva doesn't really like when I teach this parak. I taught it in yeshiva many years ago because I come home with a lot of funny ideas what kinds of brachos you are and aren't supposed to make. Even yesterday, Rabbi Lukstein and I were talking at the meal about this. Many people are not aware that you're supposed to make a bracha on dessert. We tend to think that making a bracha on when you wash and you make hamotzi exempts everything goes in the meal. So most things go in the meal, but what comes after the meal is not necessarily exempted by that. So there are a lot of halachos in this parak, also about those kinds of things, about specific brachos, what brachos you make on particular foods, and often is the case. Common practices don't always conform to the letter of the law, and sometimes also there are issues with identification or misidentification of species. Amongst my favorite example, some of my students know this, the identification of Shibola Shu'al as oats is most likely a mistaken identification, almost certainly, in fact, a mistaken identification. We talk about the Chamesha Simine Dagon. There are five species of grain that have the status of grain so that bread that you make out of it is hamotzi, you wash and bench on it, you can use it for matzah, it creates a problem of chametz, and we often identify the species as, you know, the Gemara says, chitim, sa'orim, kusmin, shibola, shual, and shifon, which are usually translated as wheat, barley, the last three, I'll just say, are spelt oats and rye. And two of those identifications are almost certainly are certainly wrong in terms of what Chazal were talking about, because they were species of grain Chazal would never have seen that was oats and rye. They didn't grow in Eretz Yisrael. They can't grow in the climate of Eretz Yisrael. The truth is, what's that? So spelt is a species of wheat. Professor Yehuda Felix, Alav Hashalom, who was a famous botanist, and he wrote a couple of very important works on zoology and botany. You know, the animals, and flora and fauna in the Mishnah, and flora and fauna in the Torah, Tzomeach v'chai b'Mishnah. So he identifies Shibola Shul as another species of barley. It's called two-row barley. I think our barley has either four or six kernels in a row or something like that. And the fifth...
There was pine corn and emmer wheat. So there were like three kinds of wheat.
So right, so he identified, firstly, he says that, if I'm not mistaken, Shibola Shul is double-row barley. He says that kusmin is not spelled. Shifon, I think he identifies as spelled, and kusmin he identifies as rice wheat, which is a species of wheat. So you can look, if somebody reminds me, I can scan those pages just to show you what his identifications are. So this can sometimes be challenging in that way, that the species that are identified are sometimes, Chazal knew what they were identifying, but we may not know what the translations are. And what happened?
Gluten-free world.
So the reason why we know that oats can, let me say the following without going further than that. I think I once gave shiur on this actually many years ago here. Rye, while it's not one of the five species Chazal identify, rye is dagan. It has the status of grain because it has, like barley, it has a small amount of gluten, and therefore the definition of dagan in halacha is something that can become chametz. That's where it all starts from. Something can become chametz, a species can become chametz, can be used for matzah, and there's gzeira shava, the word lechem and lechem, from matzah to challah, and it's from there that we get hamotzi and berachas hamazon. So the definition of lechem is something that could become chametz potentially. Rye has gluten in it. Gluten is what allows bread to rise. All other grain species like rice and sorghum and millet and oats, so they have sugars that will turn or starches that will ferment, but they will not leaven, and therefore they do not meet the definition. It has chumras and it has kulas, it has stringencies and leniencies. Rav Shechter no longer. I think he used to make hadam on his cheerios. Now I think he sprinkles some wheat bran on it. So he used to make mazonos. I don't really eat cheerios, but if I did, I would make hadama on it and a bar nefashos afterwards. But it doesn't mean that you can't use it for matzah on Pesach. The whole reason why people who have celiac want to use oat matzah is precisely for the reason why it's actually not part of the mitzvah of matzah, because it cannot become chametz by definition.
And none of those
would be hamotzi. None of those would be hamotzi, or even nor typically mizonos. Rice is that strange exception where we make a mizonos before, but we make a bar nefashos afterwards. You might be yotze if you made a bar nefashos, but the ideal bracha would be hadama, like corn, like what we call corn, maize, thank you. All of those things we make hadama on, with the exception of rice, which is a little odd, but we'll make a bar nefashos afterwards, so I think that oats would really fall in that same category. I don't eat oatmeal on Pesach, by the way. I'm not lenient on Pesach issues with oats, but I tell people who can't eat wheat matzah because they really will get sick from it. You can use oat matzah. You can make, even if you made hamotzi, it doesn't matter, but let someone else make the bracha of alachilas matzah. That you shouldn't do, because that I think would be a bracha levatala. I think if you made hamotzi lechem and aretz, I think b'dieved, you're yotze generally, but alachilas matzah I wouldn't make. So, okay. So anyway, so that's one respect. The other respect is that there are things that we seem to ignore the Gemara. There may be defenses in Rishonim, but some of them don't even have that. For example, is that coffee you're drinking, Adrian?
Yeah.
What bracha did you make? To answer the question, I know, that's what everybody does. But the truth is, if you follow even the law of the Shulchan Aruch, for that matter, and I know the Shulchan Aruch doesn't talk about coffee specifically, On coffee, you would make ha'etz. On tea, we'd make ha'adama. On apple juice, you make shahakal. So I'll say the following, and I don't want to spill the beans all this year because there'll be nothing fun left in the barrack. But there was no pun intended there. Yes, it's very odd to us, but at least according to the Gemara, and this may change with certain respects, the only fruits whose juices you consume, whose juices you make that you don't make a shahakal on, are grapes and olive oil. If you're eating olive oil, the Gemara will talk about it on the next dot. How can you consume olive oil in a way that's normal, but you know, and not terrible for you, but that you would make ha'etz on it. But all other fruits, not just in brachos, all other fruits, the juice is not considered the ikar ha'pri. It's not really considered the fruit. But strangely enough, because that's not the normal usage consumption. But strangely enough, if you have mesh lakos, if you boil something, and this people don't know, if you take vegetables and you boil them and you strain the vegetables out, you still make ha'adama on the broth. That's called mesh lakos. That's a normal way of consuming it. And the same thing is true with the fruit soup. If you make a fruit soup and you were to cook it, let's say, or you extract flavor however you want, and you strain it out, it falls in the same category. That's called mesh lakos. Don't ask me why that's called the ikar hapri. We'll have to talk about it. That's called, like, it's still the fruit, because that was considered a normal usage. They didn't squeeze out other fruits because, generally speaking, if you squeezed out other fruits, what you got most of the time was stuff that wouldn't stay.
The point of the coffee is that the ikar.
Yeah, and it's exact. Not just that, but that's the way you. It's literally made shlakos. You're boiling it in water, extracting the flavor. You get rid of the coffee for the most part. If it's not even Turkish coffee, you try to avoid drinking that part. So that is what makes shlakos is in tea is ha'adama. Now, I don't know of anybody who actually does that. I don't even make ha'adama on my day. I don't drink coffee, but the rare occasions I drink tea, I don't actually have the gumption to make ha'adama. But,
why do you decide not to?
Well, because A, you're yotzei with shahakol, and that's the practice, but it's whatever. So we don't have to settle these matters now. We can settle these matters later when we get there. It's going to be a few blot, it's going to be a few months, but it's just kind of the example where we have these odd practices that don't always conform to the letter of the law. You should be very grateful for this, by the way, because on beer, what bracha do you make on beer? Yeah, but actually, that's not the important part. You should theoretically make mezonos on beer. But the real issue would be beer made by a non-Jew. If you were the bishul akum question would be a more complicated question. You know, Lenny doesn't want to hear this. So it's okay. You know our practice. You know our practice, Lenny, so you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay. Adrian, don't cook with the beer, you know, because I don't know if you can. What's that? So anyway, that's why it's an interesting parak, because for the most part, you know, things conform to what we'd expect, but not always. And how do you, which raises questions of more about halachic process and methodology, to what extent do you ignore ignore what the minhag is and sort of pull out what the din halacha should actually be, and to what extent does it really actually not matter? Yes, correct. Yeah, except for here it can be a great, it's a similar, remember, Rabbi, it's worth reminding ourselves, since we will yet see this, Rabbi Nutam's, everybody else would, well, probably not, Avodah Zarah, it's easier. Avodah Zarah, you just say, we live in economically difficult times, we have no choice. But Rabbi Nutam's methodology is always to reread the Gemara to make it conform to practice, which is a different style. And that is what you more likely have to do here, because these are not economic issues for the most part that are affecting us, but what bracha do you actually make? The other very interesting thing about this, and I want to engage in an activity I normally wouldn't do, but I want to start the parak by reading just the Mishnayos, so we'll skip in the Gemara to do it, because we have a tendency to read texts in light of that which we know. So I think that all of us can identify, I think, six brachos that we make on food. Shahakol, Ha'adama, Ha'etz, Mizonos, Boi Pri Agafen, and Hamotzi Lechem Ha'aretz. But one of the questions that you have to ask is that the scheme that actually always was in place? Both in the sense that we know this from the Tosefta, we know this from the Geniza, it's hinted to at least a little bit in Rabbi Yehuda's position in the Mishnah. In Eretz Yisrael especially, it seems they like to have lots of brachos. They would have lots of brachos for different things, for eating different things, whereas we tend to have things lumped into categories. Now, and the Gemara will talk about this a little bit, but we would... we would not know that there existed a lot of other brachos that people used to make, at least in some Jewish communities, in Talmudic times, and which have really been widowed out. They never made it into our practice. But there also may be brachos that you would expect to appear in the Mishnah that don't. So I wanted to just, let's get a very quick overview of the parak to understand the issues that are coming. Maybe I should always do this, but here in particular. And then if there's anything that strikes you as odd, let me know. The Mishnah says, Ketzad mevarchem al haperos. How do you make brachos on peros? Al peros ha'ilan hu omer borei pri ha'etz. On the fruits of the tree, you make a borei pri ha'etz. Chutzman hayayin, except for wine. Wine doesn't grow on the tree. The grapes grow on the tree, but nonetheless, the wine is the product of the grapes. Shalayayin hu omer borei pri ha'gofen. Then ve'al peros ha'aretz hu omer borei pri ha'adama. On fruits of the ground, which would include... What are fruits of the ground? It means things that don't grow on trees. So it would include vegetables, it would include legumes, it would include grains, anything. It grows from the ground but not on a tree. That's a question. What they thought mushrooms differently. I mean, mushrooms do grow a little differently than these other things, so mushrooms are not included in that. But the Mishnah will talk about it, actually. So I'll pay Rasa Aretz Omer Bori Pri Hadama. Chutz min apas, except for bread, shall apas omer motzi lechem min aretz. So if you take the wheat from the ground and you make it into bread, you make a motzi lechem min aretz instead of making a borei pri adama. Ve'al hayirakos omer borei pri adama. And vegetables are not called the pri adama, they're something else, its own category, but you also make a borei pri adama. And Rabbi Huda omer borei minei deshaim. He says that you make a different bracha. Desha is ground cover. And you make a separate bracha, borei mine deshaim. That's what Rabbi Yehuda says. When you continue, you got to turn a bunch of dot in.
What's the difference between Yerakos and Pri HaAdama?
So I would say that Pri HaAdama is where you eat the seeds of what grows in the ground. So grains and legumes are things that you eat the seeds, whereas that's not what you eat with vegetables typically. Vegetables, you typically eat the leaves.
So a potato would be...
No, correct, because you don't eat, you generally, if there are, I don't know, actually not potatoes grow, I know carrots grow. Carrots grow
in the ground.
Well, I know they grow in the ground,
oh.
But is there a green, are there...
They grow under the ground. Right?
No, they grow under the ground. I know, but do potatoes have any kind of green associated with them? Like, there are a lot of roots that grow that actually have leaves. Like horseradish, the part that if you're going to use horseradish tomorrow, the part that's supposed to be used is the leaves, not the root. Everybody likes the root. But anyway, so the next Mishnah is on Daf Mem Amud Aleph. And the Mishnah says, Beirech al haperos ha'ilan borei pri ha'adama yatza. If on a fruit of the tree, on an apple, you make ha'adama, you fulfill the obligation, you don't make another bracha, because the trees do grow from the ground. But if you made a bracha on your beans, so lo yatza, because those fruits that grow from the ground are not peros, are not pri ha'etz. Anything you make a shahako yirotze. Now turn the page to Mem Amud Beis. Ve'aldavar she'en gidulo min ha'aretz omer shahakol niyeh b'dvaro. Things that grow that don't grow from the ground, so you make a shahakol. And then Mem Amud Beis. Seventh, after the lines get wide. Okay, and then the next things do grow from the ground, but they're not easily edible. So alachomets on vinegar, valhanovolos, which are some type of, I think, figs or dates that fall off the tree, valhagovai on locusts, omer shakonia bidvaro. You make a shahakol. Rabbi Huda omer, I leave out Rabbi, he says, koshim and kolim mevarchan alav. Okay, so he said, whatever, I'll leave that particular line aside. Okay, then if you move ahead, I don't know if there's anything more. That might be the last of the...
There's another line.
That I missed out. Where's the Chalav and Beitzim? Is that there? No, I purposely said, well, I didn't want to do that. So, and then the Braisa has additional things that don't grow from the ground, like milk, like eggs, like cheese. So all those things that you make a borei pri, you make a shahakol on. Okay, so those are the brachos that are listed, and then the other mishnayos in the parak talk about the procedures where you have to make multiple brachos, different parts of the meal. So what's missing?
Motzi.
Nope. Mishnah spoke out of motzi.
Meat.
No, so the b'rais has meat. That's something that doesn't grow from the ground. What's odd? I think it's obvious, but that's only because I taught this Masech for 15 years ago, and it was one of those striking things for me. Where's Mizonos?
Yeah.
And it's clear that the Mishnah is talking about grain, because it says, Al priha adama, al peres adama, you say, bore priha adama, except for bread, which you make hamotzi lachem and aretz. So it's talking about wheat. Wheat is, grains are priha adama, al peres aretz. And nonetheless, the Mishnah says you make a bore priha adama, which is kind of interesting. So we will eventually touch, you know, as you well know, if you eat a cookie or you know, or something like that, a cookie is a bad example, because that could be passed on by the kisrin, but let's talk about, you have some barley, you have a chillet with barley in it, so we know that you make a mizonos on it, because you make a mizonos on barley, and if you had something similar, if you had a porridge with wheat or barley, and for those who think that oats is a grain, you make a barley mizonos on it. So the Mishnah doesn't actually acknowledge the existence of bracha barley mizonos, it comes from elsewhere. It'll come up in the Gemara. So that's just one, I think, wonderful example where you look and say, that's not what we do. It's not what we do. In this particular case, you have to get to the Gemara. But that will follow the normal method. The Gemara will talk about the bracha barim mizonos, but some of the issues that I've raised otherwise, the misidentification of things and the question of how practices have actually come into being by certain brachos. So that's not going to emerge in the Gemara itself. That's going to emerge in later literature. Okay. I'll close with just one of my favorite notes about this, and we'll pick up with this next week. If you want to understand this, I've heard from Professor Moshe Bernstein, the name of his father, Michal Bernstein Zal, who I know Rabbi Lichtstein, taught Rabbi Lichtstein Ramban only a few years ago, and that is, if you want to see the difference between biblical and rabbinic Hebrew, so one of the general patterns is that brachos, the blessings themselves, are formulated using biblical Hebrew, and the Mishnah is generally not. And the Mishnah says, Ketzen mevarchem al haperos, al peros ha'ilan hu omer borei peri ha'etz. In biblical Hebrew, the word pri is singular and plural. There is no word peros, whereas in Mishnaic Hebrew, pri is singular, and peros, which we know modern Hebrew also, is a plural. And ilan is the word. For tree, in biblical Hebrew, eitz is both wood and tree. In rabbinic Hebrew, eitz is wood and ilan is tree. So, al peros ha'ilan, the Mishnah speaking, mahu omer, borei, peri ha'eitz. Okay. With that, we close, and we will begin next week with the Mishnah.